Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world. Over the last 40 years, the prison population increased from 300,000 people to 2.3 million. One in every 15 people in the U.S. is expected to go to jail or prison. For black men, the number increases to one in three. Today's guest, Brian Stevenson, is a lawyer who has dedicated his life to changing the deep flaws in our criminal justice system. He says we have a system of justice that treats you much better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Brian Stevenson has dedicated his career to helping the poor, the incarcerated, and the condemned. His new book, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption, follows the suspenseful battle over the life of Walter McMillan, a young black man who was sentenced to die for a murder he said he didn't commit. After finally securing freedom for Walter, Brian Stevenson told the judge and the courtroom, quote, "It was far too easy to convict this wrongly accused man for murder and send him to death row for something he didn't do, and much too hard to win his freedom after proving his innocence. We have serious problems and important work that must be done in this state," end quote. Talking about the state of Alabama. So on today's Your Call, we are joined by Brian Stevenson to talk about how we can create a more merciful justice system and how can we generate empathy both for people who've committed crimes and compassion for victims. Brian Stevenson is Executive Director of the Equal Justice Initiative and Professor of Law at New York University Law School. His new memoir is Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. And Brian joins me here in studio. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
Well, it's so great to have you. I loved the story in your book, so many amazing stories. And right before we were going live, you told me that 115 innocent people have been exonerated thanks to the work of you and your colleagues at the Equal Justice Initiative.
That's right. Some of them were not sort of factually innocent, but had been illegally convicted and unfairly sentenced. But we've been fortunate to win relief for about 115 people on death row. And that's been very energizing nationwide. There are 146 innocent people who have been exonerated after being sentenced to death. It's a really shocking rate of error. For every 10 people who've been executed in this country, we've now identified one innocent person on death row. And it's just so astonishing that we have that kind of error rate and yet persist in executing people. You know, I say to folks all the time that if for every 10 planes it took off, one crashed and everybody died, no one would fly. But we tolerate this error in the death penalty system, and it's one of the reasons why we're trying to get these narratives out there that maybe will cause some of us to demand more.
Well, and every single one of these 146 people has a story, and that's what you really try to get across in your book. So why don't you just tell us about the last person that you've exonerated?
Sure. We just won relief for a man named Anthony Ray Hinton, who has spent 28 years on Alabama's death row. And we had evidence 15 years ago that proved that he was innocent. He was basically accused of these two murders in different fast food restaurants, even though he was locked in a warehouse at the time of the last crime, with dozens of people to explain that. He was largely convicted because so-called experts said that they could match bullets from the crime scenes with bullets from a gun retrieved from his mother's home. Because he was poor, he couldn't get the expert assistance he needed to rebut that. And it's been an uphill battle. We just won a decision from the United States Supreme Court in his case last February, and we're now hoping to get him out. But it's deeply, deeply vexing to see so many people wrongly convicted. I'm persuaded that at no point in American history have we had more people wrongly convicted for crimes they didn't commit in American jails and prisons than we do today.
The Innocence Project also does amazing work on this, and I feel like every 2 weeks I get an email about someone who's been let out of jail. And I often watch the videos. We've had a few of these people on the show, and it's amazing because they come out, they hug their families, and they mostly say, "I'm just happy to see the sun. I'm happy to see the clouds." You talk a little bit, you go into detail in your book about how we as a society treat people who've been exonerated. And the laws are all piecemeal, right? In some states, you might get a sum of money and support. In other states, you don't. Do you see that getting better now that this issue is getting so much more attention?
You know, I thought for a while that it was going to become uniform, that we would all recognize the need to help people who have been wrongly convicted recover. But it's really slowed down. I think that that momentum we had in the late 90s and early part of this century has really been lost. It's been disrupted by, the preoccupation with terrorism and violence. And we've just developed an arrogance about our system and our flaws and our mistakes. And we actually haven't seen much more movement in the last 5 or 6 years. And you're right. There are many states where people who have been wrongly convicted get no compensation. They get no services. And you can't put somebody on death row and try to kill them day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, and not expect that it's going to have real serious consequences. Many of my exonerated clients have been traumatized by their time on death row, time in prison.
Well, that's the other thing that you talk about, and I feel like it's we throw these numbers around, we see these faces, and it's so great that this person's out of jail. But we don't think about what they went through behind bars.
That's right. That's right. Walter McMillan, who's the subject of the book, talked about how unnerving it was. When he was on death row, they were still using the electric chair, which meant that they would shave the hair off people's bodies, strap them into this electric chair. And the guys would complain about smelling flesh burning during these executions, and you can't go through something like that and not have it haunt you for the rest of your life. And I write in the book about how Mr. McMillan developed early onset Alzheimer's and dementia. And the doctors believe that it was trauma-induced. And one of the hardest moments for me was when we had to put him in a facility where he could get constant care, and he thought he was back on death row. And that kind of trauma, that kind of heartache is really the reason why we ought to be doing more to prevent anyone from ever being put in a situation where they've been wrongly condemned.
Walter McMillan's case was one of the first cases you took on as a young man. Talk a little bit about that, because the other thing you write about is just how do you even start this process?
Well, it is, I wrote about this one because it was such a peculiar case in so many ways. I mean, first of all, they actually put Mr. McMillan on death row for 15 months before he ever went to trial. And it's the only client I've ever represented who was on death row before he'd ever been convicted. The other thing that was kind of, striking to me was that at the time of the crime, he was with about 20 people of color raising money for his sister's church. And so the whole black community knew he was innocent. They were there with him when the crime took place 11 miles away. And for them, it was like all of them being convicted, all of them being put on death row. The judge was quite insistent on keeping out outsiders. When I got involved, this judge called me. His name was Robert E. Lee Key. And he told me, I don't want you working on this case. You stay out of this. But the biggest irony for me was that this crime took place in Monroeville, Alabama, which, of course, is the community where Harper Lee grew up and wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. And that community loves that story. If you go to Monroeville, you'll see all of this memorabilia about To Kill a Mockingbird. They've renamed streets after the characters. The courthouse has been converted into a To Kill a Mockingbird museum. They put on a play every year. And yet, they were completely indifferent to the plight of an innocent African-American man being wrongly convicted and sent to death row.
You were in your late 20s when you took on this case?
Yes.
As a young black man dealing with mostly white judges, sheriffs, cops, what was that like for you?
Well, you know, I think all my life I've had to deal with the presumptions that our history of racial inequality create. You know, I grew up in a community where black children couldn't go to the public schools. And everywhere I've gone, I've had to kind of manage it. I think what was interesting for me about doing this case and working as a lawyer is that, as an attorney, I had some capacity to push back, to confront people, to challenge things. And that's what's so energizing about the work that we do. We don't just have to see all of this hierarchy and bias and discrimination. We can act on it. And it doesn't mean that we're not sometimes burdened by it. I was in a courtroom actually not too long ago, actually in the Midwest, not in the South, preparing to do a hearing. And I was sitting at defense counsel's table waiting for the hearing to start and just sitting there by myself. And the judge walked out and the prosecutor followed the judge. And when the judge saw me sitting there, he said, hey, you get out of this courtroom. I don't want any defendant sitting in my courtroom without their lawyers. You go back out there in the hallway. And I stood up and I said, oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor. My name is Brian Stevenson. I didn't introduce myself. And the judge started laughing, and the prosecutor started laughing, and I made myself laugh, too, because I didn't want to disadvantage my client. Then my client came in, a young white kid, and we did the hearing. But afterward, I was thinking about the fact that this is the judge. He has tremendous power to shape the lives of people, to judge people, and he's acting on these presumptions. And so it is burdensome. But it is also challenging and energizing to confront it by standing up for people who have been wrongly accused.
Brian Stevenson is executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, and professor of law at New York University Law School. He's won relief for dozens of condemned prisoners, including 115 who were on death row, he and his colleagues at EJI. His new memoir is Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. And Brian is speaking today at 1 o'clock at Stanford Law School and tonight at 7:30 at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on, well, I also want to talk to you about the word mercy in the title of your book, Just Mercy. But it seems like there's so much more awareness with Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. So many people are getting off death row. Here in California, we just passed Proposition 47, which would bring certain crimes down to a misdemeanor. We're now getting information about the inequalities in the justice system. So there's a lot of things bubbling up. How do you think it's changing the way people look at laws? Mm-hmm. And then what are your thoughts on the power of stories? Brian tells amazing stories in his book, and we'll go over a few of those today. What are your thoughts on this? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you have been convicted of a crime or spent time in jail, what are your thoughts on these issues? And what are your thoughts on the power of telling stories? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Well, you tell a very powerful story. When you were 28, you were driving back and forth between Atlanta and Alabama. And one night you drove home, it was late at night, and some of your favorite music came on, and you decided to sit in the car and go over some of your legal briefs. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, I was a young lawyer at the time living in Atlanta and was listening to this music from one of my favorite groups, who I'll name, which is Sly and the Family Stone. And I hadn't heard them for a long time. And I was just sitting there, and a SWAT police car drove up, stopped in front of my car. The officer got out of the car and shined the light on mine. And because I was working on a police misconduct case where a young African-American man had been shot and killed, I wanted to explain to the officer that I lived here, everything was okay. And when I opened the door and stood up, this officer drew his weapon and he pointed it at me and he said, "Move and I'll blow your head off." And I stood there and I started saying, "Look, it's okay, it's all right, it's okay, it's all right." But he stood there and his hands were shaking. He was pointing this gun. The other officer came behind me and they threw me on the back of the car. They did a completely illegal search of the vehicle. And they kept me out there for 15 minutes while the neighbors gathered and made all kinds of accusations. And it was not only humiliating, but terrifying. And for me, what was challenging about that was not just something bad happened. They ultimately let me go and there were no consequences, but I was worried about all the kids in my community, young kids of color, who had to confront people who were going to act like this with them. And I had to worry whether they were prepared to manage those encounters safely. And it is part of this burden that we have inherited because of our failures to deal honestly with the legacy of racial inequality. And it's one of the reasons why we're so anxious to talk more honestly about what that legacy has done and why we need to have a little more truth so we can reconcile ourselves to this past.
What's also amazing is you managed to say, "It's okay, it's okay."
Right.
You did think about running away, which a lot of people would have done.
Absolutely.
What would have happened if you ran away?
Well, I would have been shot. I would have been injured. There's no telling what bad outcome would have happened. And what was amazing to me about that was I was 28, had been practicing law for several years. I thought about what I would have done at 20 or 18 or 16, and it would have been to run. And it's terrifying for parents to have to prepare their children for these kinds of encounters. And of course, it's gotten much worse now because we've armed people who are not law enforcement officers with these misguided stand your ground laws. And we've made the presumption of dangerousness and guilt that follows too many kids of color an epidemic, a crisis for families that are trying to keep their children safe.
And this experience led you to speak at churches and community centers to let people know this could happen and this is what you should do.
That's exactly right. I wanted every person I knew, even kids I didn't know, I was grabbing kids off the street who were strangers, to be prepared for it. Because the idea that we would lose more children to this bias and bigotry, to these presumptions, was just heartbreaking. And, you know, I am persuaded that in order for us to move past these kinds of issues, and they keep manifesting themselves, Ferguson is just the most recent example, we've got to deal a lot more honestly with the way in which our thinking has been corrupted by narratives of racial bigotry and bias. I do think narratives are really powerful. The status quo, mass incarceration, has been sustained by a narrative. The politics of fear and anger have created a political environment where everybody's competing to see who can be toughest on crime. And it's created a vacuum. And that vacuum has been filled by private companies that are now exploiting economically over-incarceration. So we've got to change the narrative that has created over-incarceration.
Brian Stevenson is author of the memoir Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. He's executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. He and his colleagues have freed 115 people from death row. And he'll be speaking at 1 o'clock at Stanford Law School this afternoon and then tonight at 7:30 at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. And let's hear from a few callers. We almost have full lines. Let's go to Jane in Corte Madera. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. As I told your screener, I am a volunteer at San Quentin. Oh, good morning to your guest, first of all. I am so happy to hear him. I love people who were involved in this particular activity, and I wish to and am involved in it also through financial contributions to organizations that do this sort of work. But I've been at San Quentin for over 10 years as a volunteer, and I have seen a lot in what goes on in the prisons system. San Quentin is one of 34 prisons in California, and the only one that really has as many programs as they have, and they really, I have to commend them. They do have a lot of programs. There are a lot of students who take the classes, who better themselves, who even get college degrees. The problem that I have with it is when they're paroled, when they go out the gate, that's the last the prison ever hears of them. They don't track these people. They don't find out whether they've been successful out in the outside world. And my experience is they are not. Mm-hmm. They're given a couple hundred dollars when they leave. They're given a pittance of support from the state of California. They're under the thumb of the CDCR, the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. So their life is really not much better when they get out. Their living conditions are terrible. And I don't know that anything great goes for them in those halfway houses. I don't think they're necessary personally.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right that one of our big challenges is that with so many people in jails and prisons, we've got to create a whole new infrastructure to help people recover from decades of confinement. There are 6 million people on probation and parole in this country. We have not created the infrastructure needed to help them live safely, to stay out of jails or prisons. The prison population is largely sustained by people going back to prison, sometimes for technical violations of probation and parole. They haven't committed new crimes, but you owe the state a monthly payment when you've been released. You can't move without getting your address approved. There are all of these technical things that people sometimes can't manage, and they get sent back to prison. So post-release and re-entry are big challenges in America right now that we haven't really confronted in the way that I think we have to. It's so much healthier for us to invest in creating meaningful supports to keep people out of prison rather than waiting until they fall down and then spending $60,000, $70,000 a year to keep them in prison for something that we could have prevented. So I agree with the caller that we've got to think a lot more critically about the reentry needs of millions of people who are being released.
Can you point to any programs across the country? that are doing this well?
Yeah, the premier program in the country is actually here in California in San Francisco, Delancey Street. Mimi Silverberg has done a brilliant job in creating a model of support and services for people coming out of jails or prisons and also keeping people from going to jails and prisons when they're diverted. They now have programs not only in the Bay Area, but in Los Angeles and New Mexico, New York, North Carolina. And I think they're just a great model. What I'd like to do is to have our prison population decreased and stop spending $80 billion a year and give that money to people like Dr. Silberg and others to replicate these programs in every community across this country, because that's the model that will actually not only create public safety, but create healthier communities.
Yeah, and if you want to check out Delancey, they run a restaurant and a cafe over by the ballpark. And we should do a show on that because they do amazing work. Well, thank you for calling in, Jane. Let's go next to Bruce in Santa Cruz. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, and I think your guest is doing great work, and I just wanted to get his opinion on a California case that's supposed to be the worst case in California history, and that's the case of death row. Lawrence Whitaker, who has been on death row for 25 years, who doesn't deny doing the crimes of torturing and killing teenage girls and tape recording it. The original prosecutor, Stephen Kay, broke down in tears, as did the whole courtroom. And the original prosecutor who won the case in the U.S. Supreme Court has passed away in 2010. And I just was wondering, how do you feel about those people that are, it's great what you're doing for the ones that are not guilty, but these people that have done horrid crimes, do you feel that they need justice?
Well, I do. I mean, I certainly think that anybody who commits a violent crime and is a threat to public safety has to be incapacitated and that we shouldn't accept that kind of violence and criminality. But I don't think we should be executing people, and that includes people who have committed even the worst kinds of crimes. For me, the death penalty isn't a question that can be answered by asking, do people deserve to die for the crimes that they've committed? I think the threshold question is, do we deserve to kill? And in our haste to kind of get to people like that, we've created a system that also picks up people who are not as culpable, who are not guilty, and that's the problem. We have a system that has been undermined by poverty and politics and race and an insensitivity to disability. And because of that, we, in my judgment, can't be in a position where we execute anyone. But I also think that there's always more to the narrative than the crime that we read about. The question I want to ask is, why did that person do that? Mm. And we've got a lot of people on death row that have been tortured and abused. And usually, in my experience, the more horrific the crime, the more horrific the narrative of torture and abuse that gave rise to that crime. And we've got to stop acting as if it just happened and now we can react it that way. We've got too many people in America born into violent families. They live in violent neighborhoods. They go to violent schools. They're chased by violent gangs. Their lives are shaped by violence. They are traumatized. They're disabled. And we don't do anything until they react violently one day. And then we jump on them and we beat them up and we make them the poster child for all of our anger and rage. And I think that's dishonest. And while we have to punish people who have acted violently and hold them accountable, I think we've got to start asking better questions about what we do to create a safer community, a safer society. My grandfather was murdered when I was 16 years old by a bunch of young kids. He was 86. He had nothing. He was living in the projects. And there were a lot of people saying, jump up and down and figure out what the harshest thing you want to have happen to these kids. My grandmother said, well, I want to create a community where kids don't murder older people like this. I want to figure out what we do to make this kind of activity and violence stop. And that's where I think we've got to be focusing a lot of our resources.
Thank you for the call, Bruce. Today I'm speaking with Brian Stevenson, Executive Director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, and author of the new memoir, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. What are your thoughts on the power of stories and how it affects the justice system? We'll be back after this.
This is your call on Local Public Radio, KALW. If you'd like to join today's conversation with a perspective that you haven't heard or a question you feel needs to be answered, join by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC here on KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be discussing media coverage of the midterm elections, voter ID laws, and voter suppression. We'll also talk about the mass protests in Mexico over the disappearance of 43 students. And if there was a story you saw that you'd like us to discuss tomorrow, you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also email us a show idea or a guest idea. Today, I'm joined by Brian Stevenson. He's a lawyer who's dedicated his life to changing the deep flaws in our criminal justice system. Over the last 40 years, the prison population has increased from 300,000 to 2.3 million. We are spending now $80 billion a year on the prison system. 6 million people are on probation or parole. Brian is executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, and professor of law at New York University Law School. His new memoir is Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. He's speaking this afternoon at 1 at Stanford Law School, and tonight at 7:30 at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. And if you'd like to join us, we'd love to hear from you. How can we generate empathy for people who've committed crimes and compassion for victims? And can or how can individual stories help create a more merciful justice system? And what would that look like? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a web comment at yourcallradio.org. Continuing on Bruce's question, in your book, you tell stories about children, about mothers, about people with mental illnesses. Almost all of them have been abused as children. Yeah. Almost all of them have seen violence in their homes. I mean, horrific violence in their homes. What sort of reaction do you get from people when mm-hmm. you tell those stories? Because we're all surrounded by heinous crimes.
Sure.
I mean, I grew up in Petaluma. Polly Kloss was kidnapped out of her bedroom
sure.
and killed. I mean, we all have this in our lives. So how do you do that? And what kind of reaction do you get?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think our policies have really been incident-driven. We've had sometimes really bad crimes that we convert into bad laws that become bad policies because we're focusing on that particular narrative. And I don't think we've done a very good job at contextualizing narratives, because the truth of it is that our jails and prisons are filled with victims. Victims of child abuse, victims of sexual abuse, victims of neglect, victims of domestic violence, victims of robbery and murder. Many of my clients have seen parents shot and killed in front of them. And we don't respond to the victimization of the poor and of people of color in the same way that we respond to the victimization of some people. And because of that, the narratives have gotten skewed. When I think we contextualize the lives of people, people react very differently. Death penalty work is really about mitigation, creating a narrative that gets people to appreciate the story behind the act. And when I think people hear these stories, I think it does change their perspective. But we've done a very poor job of dealing with offenders who've got disabilities and who are vulnerable, but also dealing with victims. I write a lot about mm-hmm. victims in my book, because what we've done is just promise people vengeance and harsh punishments. We actually haven't given them the counseling that they sometimes need or the resource and economic support that they sometimes need. We've just promised them more blood. And that vengeance and anger ends up leaving a lot of people feeling pretty empty and disillusioned. And so it's unfortunate that we've created this kind of dichotomy that you're either an offender or a victim. In my world, I see lots of people who are victims who then offend others. I see lots of people who are victims who've offended. It's just not healthy, in my view, to think about justice through that kind of lens. We've got to think about people as human beings with basic needs. And when those needs aren't met, we're creating risks that we need to minimize.
Some of the victims in your book told you that they didn't want
the death penalty or right. life, for example, but no one ever asked them.
That's right.
Other victims had never been visited yeah. by anyone involved in the process. You yeah. had visited some victims 3 years after the crime was committed.
That's right. That's right. No, it's
is
one
this
of
common?
It is common, particularly in poor and minority communities. I mean, we just tend to have a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. You know, in California, for example, 34% of all homicides do not result in an arrest. 46% of all rapes do not result in an arrest. The overwhelming majority of these cases are poor and minority victims. And if you ask law enforcement why this is the case, they'll say, well, we don't have the resources to investigate those kinds of crimes. And yet we spend almost $200 million a year to keep people on death row. California has the largest death row in the country. Over the next 5 years, we'll spend close to $1 billion, and we won't probably execute anybody. And it's one of these things where if we were really serious about dealing with victimization, particularly in the communities where crime is at the greatest threat, we would redirect some of those funds to help people who are facing elevated risks of homicide and rape and abuse and really begin to deal honestly with public safety.
Brian Stevenson is author of the new memoir, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. Let's hear from Margie in Salinas. Hi, Margie. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rose, and I'd like to say thank you very much to your guest, Mr. Stevenson. I greatly admire your work, and I just really want to extend my thanks for just the fact that you devoted your life to this.
Thank you.
You know, in Salinas, we kind of like Ferguson, we've had shootings, officer-involved shootings. Just this year, there have been protests regarding four, and then over about a week and a half ago, over last weekend, there was another death, which involved officers and taser. And I'd like to know, you know, we've asked our city council, we're trying to get an oversight or commission, and because the model that they have is, you know, doesn't have much power, well, part of the people, with the model that they have, and it actually involves police officers policing mm-hmm. themselves. Can you give me an idea of models that you've seen that are, that, have more teeth to them, some of the areas that have done this, where I look to do more research? Because, you know, we feel that there is discriminatory practices in the city, and, you know, we'd like something that gives more oversight
sure.
to the citizens.
Sure. No, I think it's a really, really important idea and a necessary idea. And there are civilian review boards in some communities that have a lot more influence over police policy. Detroit has done some interesting work on that issue. Some police departments have actually initiated reforms and input from community members in ways that have, I think, greatly increased the credibility of law enforcement in those communities. Seattle's an example, San Antonio's an example. But I couldn't agree more that you've got to have people expressing concerns about the attitudes of law enforcement. There's a brilliant social psychologist here in the Bay Area who teaches at Stanford, whose name is Jennifer Eberhardt. She just won a MacArthur. She's done some extraordinary work on unconscious bias. And what she does is actually do trainings and presentations for law enforcement officers that basically demonstrate the ways in which they're much quicker to assume the guilt or dangerousness of a person of color than a non-minority, and how that plays out in some of the very simple policy and day-to-day decisions that they make. And she's had, I think, a really powerful effect on these departments when they've opened up themselves to learning about the ways in which they've got to reacculturate when it comes to dealing with poor communities and minority communities. And that's just a start of the kind of programming that I'd like to see law enforcement communities across this country embrace. The Department of Justice is now encouraging that. Some communities can actually get funding from the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention for these kinds of initiatives. And we've been urging that funding go to community groups like yours so that these civilian groups can also be partners in efforts to promote more safe and healthy communities.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. Have you been in, I'm sure you've been in dialogue with law enforcement on a regular basis. Well, what are your thoughts on what's going on right now? There's a lot of tension happening on the streets. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of these cop watch organizations. Mm-hmm. There's dialogue happening. Mm-hmm. Do you see changes?
I do. We were just doing a program in Boston, actually, where we had several law enforcement officers there. I think most of them really want a different paradigm. They want to be people who feel good about their jobs. They want to believe that they're contributing to the health and safety of a community, but they're really not able to feel that way when they're not equipped to deal with some of the problems that they're seeing. Mental health is a huge problem in American society. About 50% of the people in jails or prisons have mental disabilities. 20% of them have severe mental disabilities. And when I talk to law enforcement officers, their biggest complaint is, I'm not getting the help, resources, and support I need to help manage people who are clearly suffering from disabilities. My only option is arrest or non-arrest, jail or not jail. And I think one of the things that we can do is to create a law enforcement community that has the capacity to deal with mental health, that has the capacity to deal with drug dependency. And if we started dealing with drug dependency as a health issue rather than a crime issue, we could redirect people who are in crisis and actually help them recover. Right now, we just kind of throw them away in jails and prisons, and they don't feel good about that either.
Brian Stevenson is author of the new memoir, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. He's executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama, and professor of law at NYU's Law School. He'll be speaking today at 1 o'clock at Stanford Law School and again tonight, 7:30 at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Surely Doomed, Chapter 6, was one of the hardest ones for me to read.
Yeah.
Really intense about children in prison.
Yeah.
And at some points in your book, I had to say, okay, he's writing about the 80s and the 90s, not the 50s and the 60s. Charlie's grandmother contacted you and said, Charlie has been in jail for 2 nights and I can't get to him. I'm in Virginia. My health is not good. Please tell me you'll do something. And you write in your book that only a handful of countries permitted the death penalty for children, and the U.S. was one of them. Many of my Alabama clients were on death row for crimes they were accused of committing when they were 16 or 17. Many states had changed their laws to make it easier to prosecute kids as adults, and my clients were getting younger and younger. Alabama had more juveniles sentenced to death per capita than any other state or any other country in the world. First off, can you tell us about Charlie and talk about how common his situation is? He was 14 years old when you met him.
Yeah. Well, it was a tragic situation where he was living in a house where his mother was repeatedly the target of a lot of domestic violence. Her boyfriend would get drunk and sometimes become very violent and abusive. And this man came home one day and just punched this boy's mother in the face, knocked her unconscious. She was lying on the floor. He ran in and tried to help her recover, and she wouldn't wake up, covered with blood. And he ultimately ends up going in the bedroom, and while this man is sleeping in this kind of despair and anger over what's happened to his mother, shooting this man. He was a 5 foot tall kid. He was under 100 pounds. He'd never been in trouble before. He wasn't a bad kid. And they put him, they certified him to stand trial as an adult. He probably would have been certified to stand trial as a juvenile, except for the fact that his mother's boyfriend, the man he shot, was a deputy sheriff. And that made the prosecution insist that he be tried as an adult. They put him in the adult jail. He'd been there for 3 nights by the time I got to him. I couldn't get him to answer any of my questions when I was sitting there talking to him. And finally, I got up and I walked around the table and I sat close to him and I said, look, you got to talk to me. I can't help you if you don't talk to me. And at one point, I put my arm around him, and he just kind of collapsed into me and started crying. And through his tears, he began talking to me, not about what happened with the man, not about what happened with his mom, but he started talking to me about what happened at the jail. And on the first night, he had been abused by several people. On the next night, he'd been sexually assaulted and hurt by several people. And on the night before I'd gotten there, so many people had hurt him, he couldn't remember how many there had been. And I held that little boy while he cried hysterically for almost an hour. And the question I had when I left was, who is responsible for this? Mm-hmm. And I realized that we are. We've created a society where we are now criminalizing children at younger and younger ages. We let these narratives of super predator and all this other nonsense emerge. And today, we have 250,000 people in adult prisons that are serving long sentences for crimes they committed as children. On any given day, there are 10,000 children in America under the age, 17 and younger, in adult jails or prisons. We have some 3,000 children that have been condemned to die in prison with these life without parole sentences.
You, in some of your talks, you talk about Charlie and a couple wanted to get to know Charlie, yeah. So they corresponded, yeah. They became very close. I mean, I could talk an hour on every yes. single person in this book, but where is Charlie today?
He's doing great. As I mentioned in the book, yes, I was talking about him. There was this wonderful, beautiful older couple that just, we cannot rest until we do something to help that child. And I tried to discourage him because I knew it was going to be a big challenge, but they weren't to be turned around. And they got involved in his life and basically adopted him and embraced him. And he's now graduated from college. He's gotten married. He's doing wonderfully.
You also write about Ian Manuel, who shot a woman at age 13. He was kept in solitary confinement, a concrete box the size of a walk-in closet, for 18 years.
Yeah, he was 13 years old. It was an attempted robbery. And he was so small, they didn't want to put him in the main dorm, so they put him in solitary. And once you're in solitary, you have to behave in a particular way to get out. And because he was 13, he was never able to do that. And so he spent 18 years in solitary confinement, deeply traumatizing, multiple suicide attempts, incredibly torturous, abusive thing to do to a child. And he's no longer in solitary, and we're working with him. But it's going to take a while to create the kind of intervention necessary to recover from that. And we do that all the time because we put so many of these kids in adult facilities. You're left with these horrific choices. Do I put them in the dorm or in the cells where they're going to be abused and assaulted? Or do we put them in solitary? Will they be incredibly undermined by the isolation and the torture of that kind of circumstance?
A lot of reports over the years have exposed abuse behind bars. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about women in just a minute. But have things changed? I mean, can you say that children are still being abused behind bars? Is it pervasive today?
Oh, absolutely. We still have 29 states that still put kids in adult jails and prisons. We've made some reforms. Congress passed the Prison Rape Elimination Act almost 12 years ago, but they haven't been enforcing it. There's no enforcement mechanism. And so, yes, it's still a problem today. I think one of the things that we're pushing is to get the courts to disrupt this, because sometimes you have to get past the legislatures and political bodies, as you've seen in California, and get our courts or get the people to demand the reforms that are needed.
Brian Stevenson is author of Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. And let's go next to Anonymous, calling from the road. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hello. Yes, first of all, I just wanted to say, that I really appreciate that Mr. Stevenson has dedicated his life to this issue. And earlier, someone called in and talked about the volunteer work that she does at San Quentin. And, I felt that it's really easy to discuss this issue in kind of facile terms and to not really talk about just how pervasive issues of racial bias actually are, because the situation that I've dealt with is one where, I've been retaliated against by professors at Berkeley as well as administrators on the basis of my skin color and my race, and these people are people who, are actually quite aware of these issues of racial bias and are probably also aware of Jennifer Eberhardt's work, yet, they have supported the very issues that Mr. Stevenson works against in order to cover up Title IX violations at UC Berkeley. And, the reason that I wanted to call in is because when Mr. Stevenson talked about what happened to him in the court where he was assumed to be the defendant instead of the lawyer, these are the kinds of interactions that happen all the time. And so, we're talking about this within the confines of the criminal justice system, but we really have to talk much more broadly about the racial bias that, makes it possible for someone to be in a courtroom being falsely accused of something in the first place. And it's not just an issue that's limited to law enforcement officials, but it's an issue that's about, the entire society and the ways in which we do have these very racialized narratives of, worth, of humanity, of guilt and innocence.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think our project at EJI, our first broad project that is actually beyond the criminal justice system, is the project that we have on race and poverty. And I agree. I think there are narratives out there that we haven't confronted. I don't think we've ever really talked honestly about the legacy of slavery in this country. We had myths that sustained slavery about the deficits of African people and people of African descent, and how some people aren't as good as, aren't fully human. And the 13th Amendment didn't address those myths. And it's one of the reasons why I believe that slavery didn't end. It just evolved. And then there were decades of terrorism in this country, of lynching and violence, and then all of the decades of segregation and humiliation. And even in communities like this, where people fled the South and came here, they came as exiles and refugees, and we haven't dealt honestly with all of the challenges that that history creates. And it does mean that people sometimes are acting in ways that are perpetuating this kind of racialized thinking and racial hierarchy without even being mindful that this is very much the narrative that sustains racial bias. And so we do have to talk more broadly. We actually now have materials that I invite any of the listeners to check out on our website at EJI.org, where we're trying to change that narrative. We've got calendars, we've got reports, and they're designed to really get people to focus on the history of abuse in a way that we do better at confronting that legacy.
Are you hopeful about the conversations that we're having now? I mean, you could say maybe some of them might be shallow, or if someone's killed, we talk for a month and then we move on.
Yeah.
But conversations are really happening right now.
I think they are. I really am encouraged. We put up monuments and markers in Montgomery, Alabama last year about the slave trade, about slavery. For decades, that community had dozens of monuments and markers about the Confederacy, and they talked so romantically about that era. And I've been astonished to see the reaction. I mean, there was a lot of pushback at the beginning, but I'm encouraged by how people are reacting to that. We're going to do projects around lynching sites in this country.
Oh, wow.
And we want to create markers and monuments in places where lynchings took place. And I'd like to see us replicate the commitment to truth and reconciliation that I've seen in other countries. After apartheid, South Africa committed itself to truth and reconciliation. In Rwanda, we've seen that. You can't go to Germany without being confronted with the legacy of the Holocaust. And I think that's a healthy thing for a country that has been devastated by gross violations of human rights to do. And we've got to do more of that in this country. And I do think that it's starting.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We have just about 5 minutes left, but I really want to talk quickly about the chapter Mother, Mother.
Yeah.
Focusing on women in prison, the fact that all 5 women on Alabama's death row were condemned for the unexplained deaths of their young children or the deaths of abusive spouses or boyfriends.
Yeah.
I didn't know that women are serving jail time for having stillborn babies.
Yes. It's one of the most outrageous features of what I would call this war on women. The number of women going to prison has increased 640% in the last 20 years. A lot of it is on drug crimes and drug dependency, but a lot of it is on this narrative of the bad mother. Mm-hmm. And for poor women in particular, if you have a drug addiction issue, we've created laws in many states that now allow us to put you in prison for any kind of drug usage in or around the time of a pregnancy. And instead of helping these women become better mothers and parents, what we do is we make them and their children the victims of our ignorance, our inability to be compassionate and just. And because we've made the death of a child, of a person under the age of 14, a death penalty crime, we now have a growing number of women being sentenced to death or life imprisonment without parole if they have unexplained deaths and they are poor. I talk about Marsha Colby, one of the clients that we represented, who had a miscarriage. And because she had a history of some drug use, they basically accused her of killing her child, even though it was biologically not supported. The pathologist kind of made up this evidence. And she spent 7 years in prison under a life without parole sentence.
And she had 7 children.
She had 7 children at home whose lives were disrupted. They were displaced. And that's the thing. 70% of the women sent to jails or prisons have minor children. And those children get put in foster care. They have lives. The data on your likelihood of going to jail or prison when you have an incarcerated parent is really, really terrifying. But what's happened to poor mothers in particular, I think, is nothing short of tragic. One of the women I talk about is actually a woman who was put in jail for killing her child, even though she insisted that she never had a child. And we were able to prove that 5 years before she allegedly had this child, she'd had a tubal ligation that made it physically impossible for her to get pregnant. And even still, it took months to get them to release her.
Are these all black women?
Most of them, but not all of them. Marsha Colby is a white woman who was displaced after Hurricane Katrina, Katrina, Hurricane Ivan. And because she was poor, living in a trailer, they assume the worst, despite the fact that she had very loving relationships with all of her children.
And Marcia actually spoke at one of your fundraisers in New York City.
Yes, and in fact, I just was in Huntsville, Alabama, two nights ago, and she was there with me, and it was wonderful to see her.
You also write that women at, is it Tutwiler?
Tutwiler, the
women's prison in Alabama, are repeatedly harassed, exploited, abused, and assaulted by male officers in countless ways.
That's right. The Justice Department actually earlier last year finally joined us in condemning that prison where dozens of women have been raped and abused and sexually assaulted. Horrific, horrific environment. We had several women who were pregnant as a result of these assaults, with DNA confirming that these officers had raped and abused them, and still none of them were being held accountable. The conditions of confinement for many women incarcerated are quite horrific. And
we don't have time to take Mimi's call in Monterey, but I'll ask for you, Mimi. She wanted you to talk about low-income people who are often talked into plea bargaining, even when they're innocent.
Yeah, I think one of the burdens of poverty is that you are completely at the mercy of a system. They will move your case when they decide to move your case. People wait sometimes for months to get access to a lawyer. And when you're looking at a sentence of a year or 2 years or 5 years, it's really difficult to say, no, I'll stay in jail and keep fighting to prove my innocence, rather than I'll lie and say I did this just so I can go home. And the difficulty with that, of course, is that with three strikes laws, you do that once. If something happens again, you're then facing mandatory sentences. So the inability to provide legal services to the poor creates a system where people are often coerced into outcomes that are very unfair and very unjust.
We've got about a minute left. Yeah. When we talk about these issues, we often use the word compassion.
Yeah.
Your book is Just Mercy. Mm. Why did you choose the word mercy?
I'm persuaded that we have become too myopic and harsh and hopeless. You know, I believe that injustice prevails where hopelessness persists, and that hopelessness is rooted in our idea that people can't do better. I'm persuaded that each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. I believe if somebody tells a lie, they're not just a liar. I think if you take something, you're not just a thief. I think even if you kill somebody, you're not just a killer. There is more there. And if we look for that more, we will find it. But to do that, we've got to be more compassionate. We've got to be more merciful. We've got to look for the forgiveness that we want for ourselves by giving it to other people. Look for the humanity we want for ourselves by giving it to other people. And I think our system is doing a really poor job of that right now, which is why I would love to see Just Mercy kind of become our organizing feature of our system.
Brian Stevenson is author of Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. He's speaking today at 1 o'clock at Stanford Law School and tonight at 7:30 at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Brian, thank you so much for coming in.
Very welcome.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the midterm elections, voter ID laws, and voter suppression. We'll also talk about the mass protests in Mexico over the disappearance of 43 students. We'll be joined by Salon's David Dayan, Brad Blog's Brad Friedman, and the Dallas Morning News' Alfredo Corchado. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We'll be right back.